Hello, this is Matthew Bronson, and this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson here on KUPR 99.9, Placitas, New Mexico. And today our conversation is with Dr. Doris Fields, currently of Placitas. So welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
I always like to be polite, regardless of what some people say. How would you like to be addressed during the interview?
Oh, you can call me Doris. It's fine.
Perfect. It makes it easy. Maybe the first thing that we'll get to is, when did you come to Placitas?
When did I come to Placitas? I came to Placitas in 2000. I moved here in 2000. Came from Santa Fe. I've been in New Mexico now, actually next month will be 53 years. So I've been in New Mexico for a long time.
So right out of elementary school?
Not exactly.
Okay.
Close.
But 53 years.
Yeah.
I think, you know, on some stage shows or whatever, someone will say, well, you know, who's been married the longest? Mm-hmm. You win the prize of all the people I've interviewed by being here at least 18 years longer than anyone else.
My.
So do you know anyone who's been here that long?
Lots of people who were born and raised here.
Yes. Well, that's cheating.
And yeah, that is. Well, it's not exactly cheating. But no, I don't know that I know of anyone else who's been here in my life right now that has been here more than 53 years. Yeah. No.
Okay. And you said you came from Santa Fe?
From Santa Fe, I moved here to Placitas.
Is that another word I have to learn? It took me to do Mayor Torres and Placitas, so it's Santa Fe?
Santa Fe.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
See, it's already been worth speaking with you this morning, Doris.
Good, thank you.
I got the Rio Grande down, you know, mm-hmm. the young Rio Grande. Mm-hmm. So, all right, Santa Fe. We'll add that to my lexicon. How did you get to Santa Fe?
Well, okay, so I should back up and not all tell right. you step by step. I should tell you actually I came to New Mexico in 1964. And then I lived in Albuquerque at that time.
For business?
No. I was married, and my husband was in the Air Force.
Okay.
Yeah. Since then, divorced, and actually needed to stay in New Mexico. Yeah.
We can talk about that if you want.
Okay. Well, I just needed to stay in New Mexico. Actually, when I came,
You didn't have, like, a restraining order that said you couldn't leave the state.
No, I didn't have a restraining order. But I spoke some Spanish, and I really wanted to speak more Spanish. In fact, I was surprised when I got here that so few people spoke Spanish. I thought I'd be speaking Spanish, like, all the time, and, you know, everybody spoke English.
I think that's crazy, because I've met a lot of native New Mexicans mm-hmm. who have been here from the Spanish land grants of the mm-hmm. third or fourth generation. Mm-hmm. They don't speak a word of Spanish. Mm-hmm. It's like, shame on you.
Yeah. Well, actually, in my time being here, there have been various points at which I was in environments where I spoke quite a bit of Spanish. For example, when I worked for the Department of Health, I traveled to various parts of the states where people only spoke Spanish, and so I had to speak Spanish there. So you know, there were a number of places where I could actually speak Spanish.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So I interrupted your journey.
That's okay. My journey was that I came here to New Mexico, lived in Albuquerque first. Then I stayed in Albuquerque until 84. I went down to Las Cruces and did my master's degree down there.
Which I understand we just call Cruces.
Yeah, we call it Cruces.
There's Cruces, there's Flag,
yeah.
There's Prez,
yes.
Healthcare.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a whole,
yeah.
I need a New Mexico to English dictionary.
I think such a dictionary would be very useful for people coming in.
Because I did see one when I was in Huntsville, Alabama, in the airport. There was a Southern to English dictionary.
Oh, really? Okay.
So maybe we'll work on that.
Okay, that sounds good. So let me finish my journey. Went down to Cruces for a year. I mean, actually, yeah, for a year. And did all my graduate, you know, coursework and research and so forth. Then moved to Santa Fe, stayed in Santa Fe for 16 or 17 years, something like that, and then moved down here.
Moved from Santa Fe to Placitas.
From Santa Fe to Placitas.
And so when did you discover Placitas?
When did I discover Placitas? Well, I discovered Placitas, the Placitas I know, because I fell madly in love with someone who lived here.
Okay.
And so came here, and I have still been discovering Placentas, actually.
But what did you think when you probably came south on 25 mm-hmm. and then went east? Mm-hmm. You get up past the recycling area. Mm-hmm. I find that the whole vibe, you just feel it, or at least mm-hmm. I feel it every time I come up that road. Mm-hmm. Did you have that same kind of experience?
Oh, let me tell you, absolutely. Not only then, but now, every time I am coming back into Placentas, and I turn onto 165, and I see the mountains, the sandias.
Yes.
There's just this wonderful feeling that, you know, I'm overcome. It's absolutely wonderful.
And it's every time.
Yeah, it is absolutely every time. There's not a time that I come that I don't marvel at what a beautiful place this is. And, you know, as you and I were talking earlier, not just the place is beautiful, the people. It's a beautiful place with beautiful people, I think.
I can imagine some people may not want to live in Placentas. It's just that wonderful thing that we feel mm-hmm. may be something that doesn't turn them on. Mm-hmm. And at some point, you were not in the west of the United States.
Right. At some point, I was not in the west of the United States. I was born in Memphis, Tennessee.
Okay.
And lived there until I was 18. Lived there until I was in junior high and went to Indianapolis, lived with my grandmother for 4 years.
Was that any kind of a culture shock?
That was a big difference. Yeah, that was a big culture shock. I don't know if I would call it so much a culture. Yeah, in some ways it was a shock. But it was quite different. When I was in Memphis, I lived in an all-black neighborhood.
Right.
All-black teachers, all-black everything. Principals, all the neighbors, all of that. When I moved to Indianapolis, we lived in an integrated neighborhood. So there we were physically integrated. So there were white people who lived next door to us, across the street from us, and there were also black people who lived on the other side of us and also across the street from us. People didn't know each other.
Okay.
The black people knew each other, and I'm sure the white people knew each other, but there wasn't a lot of communication, interaction among the people who lived on the street. So, and then when I went to school, and I was saying to you earlier, when I was in elementary school, all of my teachers were black, and they saw us, they saw who we were,
right,
and anticipated who we would and could become. And so they were very clear that we would have a sense that we could accomplish and that we could be. Because they had lived that life. And when I went to Indianapolis in an integrated neighborhood, also an integrated high school, integrated junior high school, actually, and integrated high school, all of my teachers are white, and all of my teachers were very clear that, you know, they didn't care whether we learned or not. In fact, they just assumed we didn't. They made that pretty clear.
Why do you think they had such a detachment from doing their job?
I don't know that I can answer that. I think we live in a society that is in many ways a very racist society. I think people function out of from where they come. We have to make, I think, serious changes. We have to be very conscientious about the changes we make. And some people are still working on those changes. And I think those teachers were at that time still working on those changes. But, you know, they had grown up in a very racist America. And they were probably didn't think of themselves as racist, I'm sure.
So you're showing your hopefulness that over time they did learn and grow.
I think that is quite possible and probable. I think we all, I think most of us continue to grow.
Right.
I really do. I think I certainly have grown since then. I anticipate or expect that they've probably grown as well.
You grew up in a traditional black Memphis family?
Mm-hmm. Traditional. I only lived with my mother.
Okay.
Well, my mother and my sisters, so we didn't have a father in the household. But you know, that was fine for us. All black neighborhood, all black people.
Lot of church.
Lot of church. Lotta church.
You were also a singer.
Is that one? I did not sing. Nobody would want me to sing.
Okay.
Once I was our choir, I was in the choir, but I wasn't one of the. I mean, I just kind of sang along with everybody else.
See, I thought that was every church-going person in the South has a great voice.
Well, you know,
it's my stereotype.
Excuse me. Well, you know, I may have a great voice. I haven't discovered it yet.
Okay.
I'm still working on it.
You continue to look.
I continue to, sing when, a song feels right for me. I just, kind of do it. But you would not want to have me be on stage anywhere and try to sing something.
I will note that.
Yes, please do not ask me to sing, because
if we have a KUPR Christmas party and do some skits, we won't put you in one where there's a singing part.
Oh, Christmas party skits, fine, but not where you want me to be serious about singing anything. I can do that.
Everyone sounds good in Christmas carols.
Yeah.
So that Indianapolis, that took you to Albuquerque?
Yes. As I mentioned, I was married to a man who was in the Air Force, and I came here.
First time out this way.
It was my first time out this way. Yeah, I had not been out. I had not been to New Mexico.
And at that point in your life, you probably hadn't traveled a lot anyway.
I was 18, so no, I had not traveled much.
And so
our travel had been in the Midwest for the most part.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So this must have been pretty strange.
It was strange. It was different. There were in Indianapolis and in Memphis, there were a lot more black people.
Mm-hmm.
And my orientation was in black community. And that's where I felt safe. That's where I felt good. That's where I,
It's what you knew.
It's what I knew, and it's what worked for me. And when I came here, it was very integrated. And, that was different.
So does that loss of the black community, that must still exist here in Placitas?
Yes, it does exist here in Placitas. I'm not even sure demographics are in terms of race, ethnicity, etc. I know there are a few black people in Placitas, and I don't know, again, what the population percentages are.
But not a whole bunch.
Not a whole bunch, but, some of us know each other, and, we get together.
You got the secret handshake.
We have the secret handshake. So not that there is a secret handshake, but sure.
Yeah. We, every group must have one. They just don't tell us. Mm-hmm. That's why it's secret.
Yeah. It wouldn't be a secret if you tell it.
So you're here out in Albuquerque, married.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, you obviously decided to go to school because you were now Dr. Fields, so something happened.
Well, something happened. Yeah, something happened. They don't just bestow these things upon you.
Unfortunately.
Actually, fortunately, they don't, because in the learning process, we get to grow and we get to learn. So, yes, I decided that I wanted to go to school, and I did. So I did. Went to school, got a bachelor's degree at University of New Mexico, and then later worked right after college, and then went to New Mexico State later to get a master's degree, and then came back to UNM and did my doctorate. But then while I was doing my doctorate, I had the good fortune to be a visiting scholar at Howard University.
Okay.
So I went to Howard for one semester, which was great. I did research there, and I did philosophy there. It was good.
And your bachelor's is in?
English.
And your master's?
Is also English, but technical writing and editing.
Okay. So that's a very specific kind of English.
Mm-hmm. It is a very specific kind of English. And then my doctorate is in communication. I actually think that and believe that we don't always even know, at least it's true for me, I don't always know what I know. I don't always know what I think until I'm writing. Sometimes I discover my own knowledge in writing, and I think that's not true only for me. I think it's true for many people, is as you are writing, new ideas emerge and new understandings emerge. So new growth occurs within the writing process.
Well, let's take a hard left.
Okay.
So you must have an opinion about texting.
I must have an opinion about texting.
As a form of communication.
As a form of communication. Well, I think communication in any form is good. As I think if we, I think we're not, I mean, I think we live in a country that, you know, prides itself on our individualism. However, I think that individualism is very superficial. We are very interdependent people. And communication is a part of that interdependence. In terms of texting, some of the things I've seen with texting is there's no writing out of the full word.
Yes.
How are you? Are you? Are you? The letter U is for you.
Yes.
One. And R, the letter R is for R, A-R-E. But it's a different language. It's just another language. I hadn't really thought about it, but as I think about it here as you ask this question, actually I think it's actually kind of nice that people are developing new languages for doing texting, for texting.
Yes.
I would hope that we wouldn't lose our old language, which has all of the letters that we have now.
Yeah, I mean, you can't write okay. That's too much. You just put K.
Right, yeah, okay, you know, so I just see it as another language, and I think it's sort of enriching for us all to have more language skills.
I'm not a big fan because I find it difficult to come to a resolution with someone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where are we going to meet and what time?
Mm-hmm.
Could take three or four texts back and forth,
mm-hmm.
when if I just picked up the phone and said, hey, Bob,
mm-hmm.
where do you want to meet and when?
Mm-hmm.
It's all done.
Mm-hmm. See, I think you're absolutely onto something there, and I totally agree with you. In fact, not just for communicating with friends, etc., but I think in terms of business, it's very important, or at least it was for me when I was working, to actually call people. And it's so true in New Mexico. At least I've found it true in New Mexico. To call people and ask, how are you doing, first of all?
Yes.
Because you don't know what they just left. And then you find out how they are. And in New Mexico, we ask, you know, how's your mom? You know, how's your brother? How's your wife? How are things going? Because we don't know what their situation is right that moment that they answered the phone.
Right.
And they may not be in an emotional place to talk about going to the baseball game.
And I don't mind electronic communication. I like email.
Mm-hmm.
I like it better than texting,
mm-hmm.
because I spent all this time learning all of these words,
mm-hmm.
and I would like to use some of them.
I want to use these words I have, yeah.
Yeah, there's this whole big book. You know,
right.
Dictionary. I always tell people, if you think about it, there is just the perfect word,
mm-hmm.
for what you're trying to express.
Mm-hmm.
And to say, oh, well, it was like a snowstorm.
Right.
You know, either it was or it wasn't.
Right,
it was a blizzard. It
mm-hmm.
was, you know, flurries.
Mm-hmm.
Take a little effort,
mm-hmm.
to help me understand what you want me to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're talking about precision. And
yes.
I agree with you. I think if we can have as much precision in our communication, I think the less anxiety and angst we can have about who we are with one another.
And was that something part of your English teaching that was prevalent in your education? You know, that we're losing it, or we need to hold on to it, or
we do need to hold on to it. But so you ask whether something was part of my English teaching. When I was, you know, I remember I grew up in Memphis, and I all black teachers and so
right.
forth. I had a fifth grade teacher, and all of us had the fifth grade teacher, who was Dr. Dixon.
Mm-hmm.
She had a PhD, and she was teaching in elementary school, and she was teaching fifth grade. She taught English. And she made sure that we knew how to write properly.
Yes.
How to speak properly. She required that we do it. There was no question. You had proper English. You didn't skip on anything. Absolutely. In fact, when I wrote my dissertation and you do acknowledgments, you include acknowledgments. I included an acknowledgment of Dr. Dixon because she required.
Did your fifth grade teacher, Dr. Dixon, did she allow contractions when you wrote?
You could use contractions because you needed to learn that there are contractions.
Okay.
But you learned that in formal writing, one never uses a contraction. informal writing, one never uses a contraction.
Do you think five-year-olds appreciated that, or it was just this mean old lady's making
fifth
me
graders.
Do it?
Fifth graders. No, we liked it. Everybody, I mean, I don't know how long she was at that school, but I had two sisters older than I, mm-hmm. and they are actually older than, yeah. They had had her.
Right.
And so they always came home, you know, practicing proper English and talking about Dr. Dixon. And so, of course, when I had Dr. Dixon, I, you know, loved and embraced that, too.
I think that there's a subtext there, Doris, and this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson here on KUPR 99.9 FM, and today we're having a conversation with Dr. Doris Fields, that by now you should know something about her, and we'll find out a little bit more. The subtext about your sisters and yourself and your classmates being so excited about learning proper English is, I think it translates to other subjects mm-hmm. that children want to learn if mm-hmm. they're just given the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
It's so. Can we say, taking a huge leap into 2016,
mm-hmm.
is the decline in education the students' fault or the system's fault? Is it the individual teachers? That's a huge question, isn't it?
That is a very huge question, and it's the. I think the answer has to be a complex one. Where does the responsibility for a student's learning or excitement about learning lie? Okay, where does that excitement lie? And I think the earliest of that excitement lays in the parents or whomever is around the child.
Right.
Because the quest for knowing and understanding and expressing what one knows, what one sees, believes, thinks, etc. That, I think, happens earliest at home. And there are many very good teachers. We have a system that seems not to honor teachers. And it seems that there are also some teachers who haven't embraced teaching. But it could be that, and I don't know this, it could be that the system doesn't allow them to the time or the resources they need to really embrace teaching.
Yes, you're right. It's a complex question with mm-hmm. a complex answer. And I guess if you were able to say, here's the answer, then we'd be able to fix it like that. And unfortunately, it's hard to know what the... It's kind of like so broken, where do we start to fix it?
Mm-hmm. I think as a society, we really don't, allow enough of our resources and our intentions for educating. We have not created an education system, early education system, that really promotes thinking and learning. So I do have some opinions, and I don't know very much about the testing issue that we have.
Right.
Testing that we're teaching students to take tests and be able to answer all the questions on the test in the right, you know, with the right answer, the correct answers. I don't know that that allows students to actually be able to think.
Well, the motivation, isn't it? That the better the students do, the more funding you get. So we're teaching to the test.
So we're teaching to the test. The more the better grades students get, the more money a school gets. But I wonder whether actually teaching to the thinking, encouraging students to actually think, giving them practical ways of doing math. Practical ways of writing, doing English, you know, learning English or learning biology or learning whatever it is. But they have some very practical ways, then they get it. I don't know the degree to which students actually keep anything that you learn in order to be able to pass a test.
Right. Yeah, it's like cramming all night before finals. How much of that do you remember 2 days later?
And what would be the point?
To get the grade.
And what would be the point?
Oh. Oh, I don't know. That is a kind of a rat hole, isn't it?
Yeah. What would be the point? You got the grade, and therefore what? What do you know? I mean, I think we would do wise to look at some other systems in the world, education systems in the world.
But don't you want good grades so you can go to the school you want to go to, so you can get the job you want to?
No, I don't.
Not you,
as
but
a matter of fact, no, and I don't want my grandkids to either. I want them to be able to think. I
yes.
want them to be able to process information. I want them to be able to understand that information that they're processing and be able to express that. And I want them to go to a school that really honors that and appreciates their thinking, not how many tests they were able to pass.
Right. But you have to admit, in today's world, when you are going out for your first job or a later job, if you've got Harvard Business School or Wharton School of Business, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean you know anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's assumed or presumed that mm-hmm. you do,
mm-hmm.
but someone who went to Howard
mm-hmm.
may be a much better job candidate,
mm-hmm.
but you get extra points because it says Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how you get around that.
Yeah, I don't know how we get around that either, but I think we must get around it. I think we must get to the point where so the assumption is that at Harvard you're going to get an education that where you actually are thinking.
Yes.
Students actually do think and are able to process. I know at Howard, when I was at Howard, you thought.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you thought in depth, and we expressed and we explored ideas in depth, and you came out proud of having been able to do that, and continuing to be able to do that.
So I think Howard is one of those schools that and I'm basing this nothing other than my life of input,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that students are at Howard because they want to be there. They have a reason to learn, whereas many people go to college because that's what you do after high school, and I just need to graduate.
Mm-hmm.
A whole different environment of learning.
Mm-hmm. I think that's quite true, that some people go to school to actually learn and grow, and some people go to school because it's expected of them.
Right. Yeah, I went right out of high school to mm-hmm. college, and mm-hmm. I was one of those people that shouldn't have. Because
mm-hmm.
it wasn't my idea.
Mm-hmm.
So I went for a while, and then we, both the university and myself, decided this was not the right time for
mm-hmm.
Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
Took a break for, I don't know, 5-6 years.
Mm-hmm.
Went back, paid for it myself,
mm-hmm.
and got a 4.0.
Because mm-hmm.
I wanted to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted. It was nice to have a 4.0.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the carrot at the end, but that was kind of a barometer of, did I really learn?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's so much more fun.
Mm-hmm. It's so much more, doing what you want to do once you have an idea of that. And some people need to be out of the academic world and into, a work world or a social world where they actually learn and know more about themselves and what they need and what they want, and then go back into college.
Sure.
That certainly helped for me, because I had gaps, between school, working at different points.
Right.
Yeah.
And you are currently an educator.
I am currently an educator.
At the University of New Mexico.
At the University of New Mexico, I teach health education. I teach health issues of death and dying, stress management, substance abuse prevention, and conflict mediation.
And after 10 years of higher institution learning in English, how do those topics relate to a PhD in English?
Oh, well, I was a nurse at a point. I mean, I have a lot of different iterations
so
in my life.
You're an RN?
No, I was an LPN.
Okay.
So I was a nurse, and I worked in public health for 25 years.
Okay.
And so I learned a lot about health and a lot about health stats and all of those things while I was working.
It was for the state or for the city?
State of New Mexico. Yeah, New Mexico Department of Health.
When you were in Santa Fe.
Well, I was in Santa Fe. Well, actually, part of the time I was in Albuquerque.
I just wanted to say Santa Fe.
I know. It's good. It feels good, doesn't it, to be able to pronounce it properly. Yes, I was in Albuquerque part of the time I was working. I was in Santa Fe part of the time. And then I was in Placitas part at the end of my public health career.
Did you travel as the public health nurse?
I traveled as a public health nurse, and actually I was a public health nurse for maybe 3 years or so, and then I moved into administration.
Okay.
So, I traveled throughout the state. Very interesting. I traveled throughout the state and worked in places where only Spanish was spoken. I worked in places where, you know, both Spanish and English was spoken. I traveled to Native country, particularly up in Navajo area when I worked the tuberculosis program. So I got to see some of the, what I consider seriously, a dearth of access to healthcare.
Right.
In various parts of the state.
I have an older cousin who spent most of her life in western Michigan with her mm-hmm. husband and family. And she was a public health nurse. Mm-hmm. And she traveled for maybe 20 years, mm-hmm. loved it, mm-hmm. you know, went through cars like every 2 years. Mm-hmm. But it just really jazzed her. I don't know if that's the technical medical term. Mm-hmm. But to be able to go out into the more rural parts of the state or those counties mm-hmm. and actually let people have the American privilege of some decent medical care.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's very interesting that you bring that. I'm not sure how much time we're going to have, but I also serve, I have the honor, the privilege and honor of serving on the, what's called a BAMD admissions committee.
Okay.
It's a Bachelor of Arts medical degree. Admissions committee is for students who are high school seniors who want to have a career in medicine and they want to practice in New Mexico. And the purpose of this program, this University School of Medicine, UNM School of Medicine program, is to actually supply physicians where there is such a dearth throughout the state. So, you know, these students come in, they want to practice in New Mexico. They want to get a medical education. They want to practice in New Mexico.
Because they're from here? Or?
They are from here. They are high school students, New Mexico high school students. Right. Yes.
That's something I've also noticed, you know, not being New Mexican. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I worked out here in the 2000s early and now living here for a while. So many people that I've known have grown up in wherever they are, the high school kids are, I got to get out of here. Mm-hmm. It's horrible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Other people, I want to move there, mm-hmm. but in like, I probably know Bernalillo more than Albuquerque, mm-hmm. but it seems like the young adults want to stay there. Mm-hmm. The same way with the, I don't remember what it's called. I interviewed Charles Aguilar about the dancing that goes on around St. Lorenzo's Day, mm-hmm. on the Montecinas.
Montecinas.
Yeah, that mm-hmm. the young Catholic children, mm-hmm. they're not blowing it off, going, I don't want this religion. They get into it big time, mm-hmm. and it's kind of, I don't want to say unique, but something special about here. Mm-hmm. They're carrying on the traditions rather than getting rid of them, mm-hmm. and people want to get educated and then come back and practice here. Mm-hmm. That's kind of unusual for America, isn't it?
I don't know what the stats are for the rest of America, but I do know.
We can make them up.
Okay, let's make them up. No, but mm-hmm. I do know that in serving on that BAMD committee, we find a good number of students whose families have been in New Mexico for generations, and some of them have been in their community for generations. That's what they know. That's what they love. That's where they feel good. And that's where they feel like they want to make a contribution. So they come into school, they get their degree, they go back. They're going to be going back into their communities to practice and to serve their community, to serve the people they know.
Yeah, I think that would be a really special way to live. Mm-hmm. Now, we've spoken about a half a dozen things that you do really well or are involved in. And, you know, from the information that we talked about before, you also are very involved in cultural programs like the Lunar New Year, the Cesar Chavez Day, or is that Cesar?
Cesar Chavez.
And the Native American Heritage Month, Disability Awareness Day, Kwanzaa, and other African American cultural celebrations. You coordinated continue to coordinate the Martin Luther King Jr. birthday in Santa Fe for their branch of the NAACP. It just goes on and on and on. You have had a full life. why not kick back and relax? Or was this kicking back and relaxing?
Well, this is I've retired from public health. I retired after 25 years working in public health. And I was also, you know, during that time involved in community work as well. Now that I'm not working in public health, I'm still teaching at the university, which I absolutely love because I love seeing students participating in students' actual learning. I love seeing a student make a transition from not understanding to understanding because there's an absolute joy and excitement that happens for them, and it happens for me as well. So why don't I just kick back? Well, I don't feel kicked back yet. I don't feel like I'm kicking back yet. I feel like I'm still doing a lot. And yes, I do think it's getting close to time for me to be able to relax a little bit more, travel a little bit more, work a little bit less.
And do you have I don't want to say a bucket list, but a TripAdvisor agenda for like the first three places you want to go?
Yeah, I would really like to go to Greece. I understand that right now, politically, Greece is not
might be a challenge.
It might be a challenge. That's a good word for it. It's a challenge. But yes, I would like to see Greece.
A particular island or just
Greece? I just want to see as much of Greece as I can.
Okay.
So I want to see Greece. I definitely want to see Spain. Let's see, what else would
be? Do you include Barcelona in Spain?
Sure.
Because Barcelonans don't consider themselves in Spain.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm interested in exploring that. You know, we traveled to France and I loved doing that. We traveled various parts around France and I loved doing that. So I'd like to do that in Spain. I would definitely like to do that in Greece. I'd like to spend a lot more time on the continent of Africa as well.
The continent of Africa, and I don't think unless people sit down and really like look at a map and think about it, it's huge.
It is huge.
So if someone's going to go to Africa for, you know, vacation for a week or 10 days, mm-hmm. you could be in South Africa, or you could go, 3,000 miles or mm-hmm. more to the north? Mm-hmm. That, I think it would be hard to pick out where in the continent of Africa I would want to go.
Well, yeah, you would. I mean, there are about 52 countries, nations on the continent, and
depending on the day of the week.
And I don't even know how many different cultural groups there are in each country.
Right.
For example, South Africa, I don't even know how many languages there are. I don't even know how many languages there are. But in terms of cultures, there are probably 10 or 12 different cultures. Well, maybe more than that.
Right.
You know, they're the San, they're the Xhosas, the Zulus, you know, the Ndebele. I mean, so what your mm-hmm. point, though, I'm just trying to expand on that point,
sure.
that even in, say, South Africa, which is only one country on the continent of Africa, there are many different languages and cultures within that one country. So you'd have to think about what, you know, I think it inspires a bit of learning about each country to decide where you would want to go. I've had the good fortune to travel in Ghana. We went to Gambia for a very brief time. Zambia.
That's all the northwest?
That's West Africa, yes.
Okay.
Ghana, Zambia, Gambia is all West Africa. Also South Africa. And Ethiopia. Ethiopia, which is east.
Being the typical American, I guess, mm-hmm. probably not typical, but certainly American, mm-hmm. the Travel Channel, Discovery Channel, mm-hmm. History Channel, mm-hmm. that's where I know about Africa. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so if I wanted to go to Africa or plan a trip, I would probably really have to do this education that you spoke of because mm-hmm. I would, in my mind, I can go on a wildlife safari. Mm-hmm. I can go surfing. Mm-hmm. I can go see Zulus. Mm-hmm. I can go see pygmies. Mm-hmm. And they're probably not all in one place. Whereas, you know, just the silly American goes, well, I'm just going to go to Africa and I'm going to see all this. It's not that simple.
No.
You have to be a little bit more specific.
Right. And I think before one goes to Africa, because people, I think, do have some vague idea based on what they've seen on TV that may not have very much to do with reality.
Right.
So it would be good to do some educating of oneself before going or before deciding where to go. And also going to learn more about that country and those people and being there.
Did you do some kind of Ancestry.com journey to Africa?
No, I didn't do an Ancestry.com journey to Africa. We have done some 23andMe ancestry work, and right. We're still in the process of doing that. But I don't know, I mean, we do know that, I don't remember what the percentages are of my own background is West African. So we also know this is historically, the history we know is right. That many Africans in America who are current descendants of U.S. slavery were actually stolen from West Africa.
Right.
But not exclusively from West Africa. Now, we have had the good fortune of linking with a family, a large family in South Africa. So we have family throughout all of South Africa that we go to visit, and they come to visit us. Right. We spend time with them.
And they, and I guess, you know, comparing people immigrating to the United States. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the Africans immigrated in a different way to America than the Eastern Europeans. Mm-hmm. And there probably was not as good record keeping mm-hmm. at that time in Africa as there was in Eastern Europe, I'm just mm-hmm. assuming. So, like I had older cousins who wanted to go see the family town mm-hmm. in Hungary. Mm-hmm. And they were able to actually go find the town and find the house where mm-hmm. great-grandma or grandpa lived. Mm-hmm. It's probably harder.
Well, what you're saying is absolutely true. And that's how one can distinguish between, see, language is very important, and you've just proved that. But it's important to distinguish between immigrating and being stolen from one's homeland.
Yes.
I don't consider the Africans who were stolen from their homeland immigrants.
Yes.
Yeah, that's not immigration. So we think of our country as a country of immigrants, and that's a piece that is, in my view, absolutely incorrect. We are a country of, and there will be other people who have even more understandings, but we are a nation of indigenous people. We are a nation of immigrants. We also are a nation of people who were stolen from their homelands and placed into market slavery and are continuing to live through that legacy of slavery. And the people who were immigrants, the white people who came, are also continuing to live through that legacy of slavery.
And is there a third category? Not that this has anything to do with conversation with Doris King mm-hmm. on KUPR, but it's interesting anyway. Say the people who, during the Vietnam conflicts and all of that, were fleeing for fear of their lives, are those immigrants or are those refugees? Or?
Well, it depends on what, again, we go back to language and the importance of language in terms of naming people. It's important for people to be able to name themselves. So I would want to know from the Vietnamese how they would prefer to be called. Would they prefer to be called immigrants? Would they prefer to be called refugees, or what they would prefer to be called? Because my guess is they have some language or sense of who they are.
Yes.
And what language they would like to be like to use to refer to themselves.
Because I guess that's part of the fun part and beauty of America is that it's just a very complex story. Mm-hmm. It's not like I'm Japanese, I grew up in Japan, and mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's so it different is. Than like being black in America mm-hmm. because not all black people look alike. I guess all Koreans don't look alike, but
I don't think You know, there are identical twins, pretty much look just alike.
Sure.
But most of us have some kind of distinguishing feature.
Yeah. I think even if you go back to the source in Africa, mm-hmm. it's not like everybody in Japan or everybody in Korea. It's not that mono look.
I think we, I don't know that there is a mono look. I think we are so, overall, we're in such a hurry that we only see the superficial. We see that which looks most different. And therefore, that which looks most different, say, whatever is a characteristic of somebody who is Korean, then we don't look past that. I think we have to pay closer attention and look for whoever is the individual. To some black people or to some other Asians, etc., they may see all white people as looking alike because what we see is white skin,
right,
and straight hair. And until we actually look more closely, mm-hmm. We don't see that there are major differences,
right?
And you can distinguish people. But I think that actually brings us to for me is a commitment to knowing more about more people.
Well, obviously, yeah. I love people, or I wouldn't
right.
do this.
Right, exactly.
When you traveled through France, mm-hmm. and then you also traveled through Africa, mm-hmm. Probably more so in France, did they make some assumptions about you from TV shows or the news, or did they, it's like, wow, you know, we don't have any black people in this town, or mm-hmm. or was there any of that?
You know, most people aren't so blatant as to come up to you and say, you know, we don't have people who look like you.
Right.
I don't remember.
That's a problem I'm working on. I don't have a filter.
Okay. No, I don't know that that people, I mean, I people may have assumed, I don't know what they assumed. They may have assumed that I was from, not American, that I was from Africa. I know that when I'm in South Africa or when I'm in anywhere in Africa, they think that I'm born, raised on the continent.
Because you wear African attire.
Yeah.
Which we didn't mention before, but yeah. That's, just to take a big jump here, mm-hmm. born in 1946, mm-hmm. what year did you adopt African clothing?
I adopted African clothing in about 1983, 84.
Okay.
Yeah, I remember specifically, actually I was in, actually it was a little bit before that, but I remember specifically being in Las Cruces, where I was working on my master's degree. I remember going to the fabric stores and picking out wraps to wear. So I had started wearing African clothing before that, and certainly, I think, from that point on. And I still, when I worked for the Department of Health, I still would wear a suit to work, but a duke on my head.
Which is the head.
Yes.
Yeah. Not a hat.
Not a hat. Some people call it a hat, and that's fine, but it's a duke or duku.
I would think it would be wildly fun mm-hmm. to have the option to dress like that, with mm-hmm. the colors mm-hmm. and the different styles. Mm-hmm. It just seems a lot more fun than I'm going to wear my cargo pants. Mm-hmm.
You know, well, it's exciting to me. I mean, it's exciting to me, and I think, I don't know if we talked about, you know, my movement toward wearing African clothing while we've been recording.
No.
But yeah, it is a very important piece for me. And it feels good. I mean, every time I get ready to dress, it's like, oh, what am I going to wear today? You know, what am I going to put on? What am I going to, you know, and it feels very good.
I feel like. Well, that I think that would be a different kind of decision as a woman, because, like, do you have an after 5 o'clock wrap and a going to the zoo wrap, or they're not delineated that way?
Some wraps are more dressed up than others. Oh, certainly. I mean, I have wraps that I only wear on fancy occasions.
And
like I wear jewelry that's more fancy than everyday jewelry.
Right. Mm-hmm. And is there some place in Albuquerque, like, is there a store now that we've become more cosmopolitan here, or you still have to kind of rely upon yourself?
I have to rely upon myself. I have to look everywhere I go. Whenever I'm traveling throughout the country, outside the country, wherever I am, I look for fabrics. And I'm very fortunate that I have friends who also sometimes look for fabrics for me when they're out traveling. I have a friend who is a fabulous, wonderful fabric artist. And she was at an exhibition in, I think, Seattle, and she brought me back a lovely piece of fabric. The fabric I'm wearing today, a friend was traveling in Tahiti and brought this back to me, I don't know, about 15 years ago.
Do the different patterns have different stories, like Scottish tartans?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
But there are some different dyes, and there are some different patterns in South Africa, for example, or as I was mentioning to you, in there's the Akasombo textile mills in Ghana, and there are some patterns there that are quite recognizable.
I don't even know all the designers, but is there a Gucci of African dress or a Yves Saint Laurent? Or
one of the things that's interesting, I don't know about Gucci or Yves Saint Laurent, but when we were in Ghana, it was really a wonderful experience that the dressmakers or the tailors would come to our hotel. I mean, they knew when we were coming. They'd come to our hotel, and they would lay out various outfits. They would also lay out various fabrics, and they would lay out patterns and different styles of dress, pictures of different dresses. So one, or pants for men too.
Right.
So you could pick out the fabric you wanted and the outfit you wanted, the design you wanted. And in a day or so, they would have it ready for you. They would measure you and have it ready.
It's like going to Taiwan and getting, three suits made.
I guess so. Yeah.
Which, unfortunately, we don't wear suits anymore because I've really loved my corporate life and being a peacock. Because men don't get to do a lot of that.
Dress up, right.
But now it's khakis and polos, no matter where. But that was always kind of a dream during that era, was to be able to go to Asia and just get a perfectly made suit. But that will never happen. Doris, and I'll remind people, this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson here on KUPR 99.9, and we're speaking to Dr. Doris Fields. I can't even put a label on her because she's so complex. So you'll just have to listen to the whole thing again to find out all about Doris, because if you're in Placitas, you know Doris, because Doris is the one wearing the African outfits. And so it's really fun to get to know the person behind the duco.
Duku.
Or under.
Under the duco.
But, being in Placitas, believe it or not, you are a jewelry and visual artist.
I am.
I believe I am the only non-physical artist in Placitas, so I'm hoping they won't ask me to leave someday.
Mm-hmm.
But how did that all start?
Well, first of all, let me just go back to one of you saying, people will know me. They won't know me. They will recognize me.
Yes.
Okay. But they won't know me. They have to do a little bit of work to actually get to know me. And I'm still working on that as well.
And this is a great start.
Yeah, this is a start. So now, what was your question?
Oh, jewelry.
Jewelry. Making jewelry.
Yes.
Well, I actually have been... My sister, back in the 70s, used to string beads, and African beads.
Okay.
And sell them.
She wasn't a hippie.
She was not a hippie. No, she was not a hippie. But she strung beads and sold them. And then after that, I would string a little bit, and I never bothered selling them because I just wanted to wear them myself.
Why?
So, I think probably in the 80s, I started collecting, I started collecting beads, African beads. And I've been collecting them, doing nothing with them. Or periodically, I would make a necklace for me and wear it.
And so, what makes a bead African?
It comes from the continent.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's a place of origin as opposed to a style or a shape or a color?
A place of origin, and may also be style and shape.
Okay.
Yeah. So then I started, I make them now. And I've been, actually, I've sold a few, but I really mostly make for myself.
Okay.
Or for family.
And they're wood or?
Mostly glass beads, African glass beads.
Okay.
I integrate also some silver or sometimes gold into them. Sometimes wood, sometimes bone.
So I'm trying to learn all the different disciplines of art, but you're making some glass beads. Is that what people call fused glass?
No, I'm not working with fused glass. I'm working with glass. Mostly, some of my beads are sandcast glass. Okay. In fact, I have some beads that are sandcast, ancient beads, over 200 years old, that or more than that, actually, that were cast to look like coral.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
That's pretty exciting.
Yeah. But I also draw using pen and ink.
And is there any place people can see some of your work?
No, not anymore. I have had gallery showings various parts of the state,
mm-hmm.
other parts of the country.
But it's not archived any place like on Facebook or DorisKing.com?
No, Doris Fields, not ever.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. That's Dr. Martin Luther King. We're talking about him a lot.
That's right. Yeah.
So, no.
All right. So, you're doing 1,000 things now. Do you have a kind of a plan as to when it's going to be 500 and then 100 and then garden?
Yeah, well, we're gardening now, but yes, I am thinking seriously about cutting back on many things. Yeah, cutting back a little bit.
It's a process.
It is a process, and one of the things that I've found true is that when I've cut back on one thing, I end up picking up something else. So I've got to get, the fine art of actually letting go and holding on to that time.
As
opposed to filling that time up with something else.
Well, I am sympathetic and empathetic to you and the plight of many people that I've been able to get to know in Placitas. Being retired for a few years and getting involved with various organizations,
mm-hmm.
and I can't believe how busy I am. I told my wife, I'm thinking about going back to work because it's so much more relaxing.
Volunteering
is
60
hours, and that's it.
Right. Yeah, you come home and you're done. And you may do a little bit of work after that, but, you come home and you're done. But, community work, I am very committed to doing as much as I can to improve my community. I feel like I've been very fortunate to be born, fortunate to have lived so long, fortunate to have met the people I've met, to have lived where I've lived, to travel where I've traveled. And so I feel very much like I want to give back. And so it's important to me to be able to do that.
And to that point, what year did you become a resident of Placitas?
I moved to Placitas, if that's what you mean,
yes.
In 2000.
And is there anything that you can say is substantively different about Placitas and as opposed to in 2000?
Oh, yeah. This library.
Okay.
And
that's
all,
huge.
It is huge. And all that it does, the volunteers, the people, and also the director who is also paid. But the people in Placitas, it is such, in my view, it's such a, the people are so beautiful in their sort of casual desire and commitment to make Placitas better. It is just amazing to me that the people in Placitas just work and make this a better place.
I'm amazed at the brain trust that is here, and that these people put it to use. And you just mentioned how wonderful the library is. We should probably give props to the community center.
Oh, yes.
Because that's huge, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
And the ladies up there and guys who work up there and volunteer up there,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's such a resource.
It is an absolute, and people use it. People go there, and there's so much there for them. I really am I feel really pretty honored to be in Los Angeles. I'm very blessed.
Yeah,
to
it's
be.
It's magical. And with that, I will thank you for sharing part of Dr. Doris Fields, the person, and not just the lady who wears the African dress. And until next time, this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson on KUPR 99.9 FM, the high desert of New Mexico here in Placidas. So thank you, Dr. Fields.
And thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.